It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Gardeners throughout the city and around the region are harvesting tomatoes, beans, squash, zucchini, cucumbers, kale, you name it, in pots, backyards, community gardens. That has to put smiles on the face of our guest. Raiden Sorok is Director of Community Projects for Grow Pittsburgh. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you very much for having me.
Grow Pittsburgh, nonprofit, established 2005. What gap was it trying to fill? What need was it trying to fill at the time?
Well, Grow Pittsburgh was started by three women who are urban growers who were just getting a lot of questions from other folks about how do I do this? And being busy farmers themselves, they didn't have a lot of time to help everyone through that process. So that's really where the organization first started, as to let's form something who can answer all these questions.
Is your goal more than go outside, plant a garden, watch it grow and harvest it? What else is Grow Pittsburgh trying to accomplish?
Sure. Well, we spend a lot of time promoting the benefits that gardens bring to our neighborhoods, whether that's in a backyard or a community garden or in schools or as small businesses and urban farms. I think another aspect of our programming that's really important is helping teach people that growing food can also be an important skill for job training for the future. And we're really excited about integrating a lot of that growing programming into curriculum in local schools.
How have your programs grown, even changed over the years? For example, you are celebrating 10th anniversary of your community garden program.
Yeah, we're really excited. The community garden program started in 2010, where just a few gardens were started that year with our support. And since then, we've been able to support 36 gardens growing in that time and supported an additional 60-plus gardens, so all over the county. And since then, we've really found that a lot of these gardens have started, but then may need some additional support maybe 2-3 years down the line. And so our programming has shifted since then to provide these gardens with mini grants, with consultation, with workshops, with other programming to help connect them to each other and to other resources.
That consultation, do you go out and see what their garden looks like and say, you know what, it could be more bountiful, it could be more productive?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of the questions that I get are from folks who are interested in starting a garden and want to just talk through what that process might look like and whether it's going to make sense for them, for their time, for their communities.
So the community garden aspect, is it because people don't have enough space in a backyard or for pots, or is it something beyond that in the name community garden?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people first come to it with that specific goal in mind. They maybe don't have enough space, or they want to grow food and they're thinking just about that aspect. But then they find that they're more connected to their neighbors. They find out what's happening in the community. They get outside, get some exercise. They introduce their kids to a lot of this growing. And then it expands to be a lot more than just a garden, that it's really becomes that community space.
Tell us a little bit about the process. How do you access the property for a community garden? Who does it belong to? Is it city? Is it vacant property? Who does it belong to?
It's really all over the place, and I think that's one of the major challenges that a lot of gardens are facing. But I recommend that gardens, garden groups that are interested in getting started, they connect with local nonprofits and local municipalities who may have vacant property that is not in use, and that they can have some sort of written agreement or contract that says that they can use that space for a community garden for a specific amount of time. Sometimes it can get a little bit more complicated with privately owned spaces if the need for that use changes.
We know there are plenty of vacant lots in the city itself. Are they being taken advantage of, or not as much as you'd like to see, maybe?
Yeah, the city has a great program called Adopt a Lot, where anybody can basically get access to that space to use it for a community growing purpose. And we've worked with many individuals and garden groups that have used that system.
So neighbors get together. They say, boy, we would like to have this. And what is their next step?
What I tell groups that are just getting started is talk to everyone you can in your neighborhood, because often the smaller group that's interested in getting started with the garden hasn't knocked on all the doors of the neighbors right around the site, or hasn't connected with the local businesses in their neighborhood. And those connections can be very, very important for the long-term success of the garden. People want to know about what's happening long before it happens, so they have a chance to get involved and offer their input. Sometimes it can be the shock of a garden going in right next door without a heads up about it can turn some people off, and you don't want to miss out on an opportunity to have a neighbor or have someone in the community be a supporter for that project.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Raiden Sorok from Grow Pittsburgh, which is marking the 10th year of their Community Gardens program. Community gardens, they often provide a source for fresh, affordable food in areas where it might be difficult to come by. How important is the impact of a community garden in a neighborhood that, you know, it might be a food desert where there is very limited or no access to fresh produce?
And that's a lot of where our focus has been in trying to start gardens in neighborhoods where there is limited food access. And because we're celebrating 10 years of this program, our party to celebrate that will be in Millvale. And the gardens of Millvale started, you know, in a food desert. There is not a supermarket in town, and the neighbors who work in that garden have been able to provide produce, fresh organic produce, to their residents, both people who adopt a plot at that site and also at farm stands.
We obviously see the tangible benefits of a community garden when the harvesting takes place, but there are other benefits that may be not so obvious.
Yeah, and I think that that's really where a lot of the magic happens with community gardens. A garden in Mount Oliver Borough works with many local residents who are Bhutanese refugees. And for them, who have a lot of experience in growing food coming from a subsistence culture, really enjoy the opportunity for especially the elders to get outside, to enjoy being in nature, to be very useful and helping to grow food for their families. So it is really both a subsistence, they're growing food for their families, and it's a great added mental health benefit as well.
Right. And do community gardens build community?
I think that they do. And I think that they work really hand in hand in both building community and the community that's around them helps build the garden. I think it's really important to make sure that the garden is integrated as much as possible into the life and the excitement in any given neighborhood.
Before Grow Pittsburgh started the community garden program, you were encouraging and helping schools to create school gardens. How has that taken off? Tell us about the process.
Yeah, that's been a really exciting development because we started with several flagship gardens where our staff was very closely working on site and building that garden and being there week in, week out with the students, with the teachers. And in partnership with Big Green, we've been able to expand that program tenfold, really, and with the goal to start 50 school gardens throughout the region within about 5 years, which is a pretty intense schedule. And we're over halfway there already. And in that program, we're working on a smaller scale with each garden group so that we can help them get started, learn about how to do the curriculum there, and then help them graduate from that in 2 years so that they can do it themselves.
You say curriculum. Tell us a little bit about the sort of maybe some of the initial schools that you worked with. But also, it's not just about a garden. You say there's a curriculum involved?
Yeah, I mean, we've been working really closely with a lot of the required curriculum for public schools to make sure that what we're doing in the garden is integrated more into what they're learning in the classroom. So one of our really exciting aspects of curriculum is working, of course, through the winter where things aren't really growing, is doing really and really exciting cooking programs with the students over the winter. So they're learning about where food is grown, they're learning about different cultures, they're learning about different cuisine, and then they get to try that food in the classroom. And it's actually a really great thing to watch where the kids are excited about trying new foods and they encourage each other to try new foods.
Grow Pittsburgh, I believe, has 3 urban agriculture sites.
That's correct, yeah.
Pennsylvania Farm Bill allots $500,000 to urban agriculture to do many things that you sort of already do: improve agriculture infrastructure in urban areas, share community resources, et cetera. Do you expect to see any of this money?
Well, we do hope so. We're definitely throwing our hat in the ring. I think that what that grant shows is that the Pennsylvania State Department of Agriculture is taking urban agriculture very seriously. And as we should, as Pennsylvania is such a strong agricultural state in general, it's just really exciting to get some attention in that area and be able to put some money towards it. We're really hoping that between all the different urban garden projects and urban farm projects throughout the state, we can max out that grant and show them that there's really a need and a desire for it.
What's the difference between urban agriculture and community gardens? Is it urban agriculture just one person having their own garden?
Yeah, that's a great question because I hear a lot of, you know, what counts as this, what counts as that. And I would definitely count community gardens as urban agriculture, mm-hmm. both because it's part of the system that is growing food for all of us. And maybe a small part of that, but it's still an important part because when the secretary, Russell Redding from Pennsylvania State Department of Agriculture came in, he was really emphasizing a lot that, you know, agriculture in general in the state grows a lot of food for people. But in community gardens, there's something that is really exciting that happens where a lot of the public can interact directly with that food growing. And then there's an education aspect. There's a learning about how food is grown that's pretty special in that department.
Secretary Redding, a guest on The Confluence about urban agriculture. You're now accepting applications for, I believe, the 2020 community gardens.
That's correct.
What are you looking for in the next generation of these gardens?
Yeah, to be celebrating 10 years is a really exciting opportunity to look back and also look forward. So we are definitely still interested in helping community groups start new gardens. And so that's what that grant program is all about. So please, if you're interested in applying, get in touch often and early so we can help you through that process. Really, we're looking for garden groups that are excited, that are engaged, that are plugged into their neighborhoods and their communities, because that's going to be a good indicator of success for any new garden project. And looking forward over the next 10 years, we're really hoping to emphasize the environmental benefits that community gardens can bring, both in terms of stormwater management, in terms of soil remediation and wildlife habitat, because those are really important roles that community gardens play as well.
So it goes beyond just harvesting those tomatoes and those beans and zucchini.
Absolutely, even though that's very satisfying in itself, for sure.
Raiden Sorok is the Director of Community Projects for Grow Pittsburgh, which is celebrating 10 years of their Community Gardens program. Raiden, thanks so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Are you a currently enrolled college student looking for an internship? Are you interested in working on Pittsburgh's only local public radio daily news program? 90.5 WESA's The Confluence is looking for interns this semester. Send us an email with your resume, cover letter, and writing samples to hr@pittsburghcommunitybroadcasting.org.
The Temptations scored a big hit with Papa Was a Rolling Stone in 1972. It's a song that's big in more ways than one. The album version runs almost 12 minutes, while the radio edit clocks in at just under 7. It's still unusual for a song of that length to become a massive hit, but The Temptations did top the charts with this story about a father who wasn't always there. It's also got one of the most memorable opening lines in rock history that just happens to sound exceptionally good today.
It was the 3rd of September, that day I'll always remember.
For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Duquesne University announced recently it would open a College of Osteopathic Medicine. About 1 in 4 medical students attends an osteopathic school instead of a traditional medical school. But most people have at best a vague understanding of the difference.
Osteo, that means bones. Pathic, I don't know what that means, but I know osteo means bone structure.
It's more home remedy. It's more natural.
They like treat some of the medical symptoms kind of like with what sounds like physical therapy. It's like, it's not like physical therapy as most people know it, but some of the techniques are like similar.
That was Jeffrey Thomas, Joyce Hull, and Osa Benjamin. One of the main differences is that DOs use manipulative treatment, stretching and gentle pressure on soft tissues and joints. As part of our occasional series, A Moment of Science, 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed speaks with osteopathic pediatrician Amy Maddalena of Kids Plus Pediatrics.
You studied at the very first School of Osteopathic Medicine, which was started in 1892 by Andrew Taylor Still in Northeast Missouri. What did Still believe, and how was he regarded by the mainstream medical community?
Well, back then, what was mainstream medicine was very different from today. It mostly was poisonous toxic substances that were introduced to the body. So arsenic was used. There wasn't a lot known then about what the basis of diseases were. A.T. Still really wanted to find an alternative to that. He had lost several family members to an illness, and so he wanted to find another way to treat patients. And so he founded osteopathic medicine on the basis of the fact that the body has healing tendencies. And if we can encourage those, then we can help the body to heal itself instead of introducing things to the body that are toxic.
What did the mainstream providers think of him? I mean, did they think he was a quack?
They did. I would say it took many years for osteopathic medicine to really be embraced. And part of that was the shift to eventually the training being very similar. So in the beginning, it was really a very wide distance between allopathic medicine and osteopathic medicine. And over the years, it's really grown together so that eventually osteopathic physicians became licensed to practice medicine in our country the same way that MDs are. In the beginning, yes, he was definitely considered out there. But then again, people sought the treatment because it worked and because it was an alternative to what they were experiencing.
How does your training inform how you diagnose and treat patients?
We're trained to treat the body as a unit. So that includes mind, spirit, you know, body. You know, we're not just asking about, you know, physical symptoms, but the whole person. Are you exercising? How's your nutrition? Are you getting outside? Things that kind of encompass and also educate our patients to the fact that we're not just looking at, you know, why does your head hurt? You know, what is surrounding that? And how can we treat your whole self?
Is there a place for osteopathic manipulative treatment in ailments that aren't directly musculoskeletal in nature, say cancer or allergies?
Absolutely. I would say someone in pain from cancer, for instance, we can work with the body's structure in relieving pain or in improving blood flow to an area to help the body work through. Now, of course, that would be in conjunction with mainstream treatments like antibiotics and chemotherapy and radiation. So it's not in place of, but it's a really good adjunct to that.
What can allopathic providers learn from osteopathic medicine?
We're seeing a trend of physicians understanding that the body is a unit, that we can't compartmentalize and treat one part of a person. And so I think that that is the influence of the osteopathic profession, that when, you know, we see a person as a whole, we want them to see their whole selves and to consider all the ways that they can encourage their health. We learn a lot about preventive medicine, and historically, osteopathic schools have focused on training primary care physicians and focused on disease prevention. So things like exercise, being in nature, things that studies, research now is showing is so helpful, sort of is what we've been learning all along.
That was osteopathic pediatrician Amy Maddalena speaking with 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed. Find more from our Moment of Science series at our website, WESA.FM. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As cities reevaluate the future preeminence of the car, small personal alternatives have sprung up. Bike share programs and fleets of electric scooters. These new modes are poised to completely reshape how cities work and how people move. But 90.5 WESA's Margaret J. Krause reports the current micro-mobility revolution misses a whole group of consumers.
On a weekday morning, the corner of Forbes and Murray Avenues in Pittsburgh's Squirrel Hill neighborhood is hopping. Cars honk, buses grind to a halt to collect riders. A walk sign chirps at a four-way intersection, while nearby someone mows a lawn. And Mark Costello unlocks one of this city's micro-mobility options, a healthy ride bike, for Nasreen Hashmi so they can take a ride together.
It's just like it made us like closer, we bond like while biking, and it's like it's just like a nice exercise and it's fun, like we have fun doing it.
And it's like $2 for half an hour, which is like in terms of entertainment, it's like not that bad, it's kind of a good deal.
Micromobility is big business, and fun is a critical part of its meteoric growth, according to a January analysis from consulting firm McKinsey & Company. Since 2015, the industry has attracted more than $5 billion of investment. Major companies such as Alphabet, Google's parent company, Uber, and Lyft have joined the fray, as has legacy automaker Ford. In 2018 alone, people took more than 84 million trips on these new modes. Like car sharing or ride hailing, the bikes and scooters of the world offer convenience and utility. But the report notes the key may be something else. Quote, they appear to make people happy. But not everyone. Donna and Sipple Holmes would love to scoot to and from work or bike along a trail with friends, but she uses a manual wheelchair.
If you want to be the least spontaneous person in the room, have a disability, because you have to be prepared to think about logistics when other people are not thinking about them. And when I first saw the Smart Drive, I thought, I can go where I want to go.
The Smart Drive.
It's the size of a very large cat.
Attaches to the back of Holmes's chair. An electric wheel rests on the surface below her and allows her to travel up to 5 miles per hour. The medical device sells for north of $6,000. Luckily, Holmes's insurance paid for hers, and she loves it.
But it's a tool. It's not super fun, and it makes me think a lot about how I'm not a consumer to a lot of the companies that offer these products.
Four of the country's five major micromobility companies did not comment for this story. A spokesperson for Uber, which operates Jump, wrote in an email that the organization has no plans for, quote, add-ons of this nature for now. Dr. Rory Cooper directs the Human Engineering Research Laboratories at the University of Pittsburgh. He says for new companies trying to establish a business in a competitive industry, it makes sense to target young people without disabilities.
But at some point, you know, you saturate your market and you got to look at other alternatives in order to expand your market.
Some 65 million people worldwide require a wheelchair, according to the World Health Organization. Providing new mobility options for those users and others with disabilities presents a huge opportunity, says Alex Hunt. He runs Rio Mobility, a company that makes the Firefly. It's a $2,000 attachment that converts manual wheelchairs into three-wheeled scooters, with a top speed that rivals that of standing scooters, about 12 miles per hour.
I said the demand grows every year. The company is viable. We're moving into, you know, different parts of the world.
To explain the gap that Rio Mobility fills in the market, Hunt introduced me to one of his customers, Catherine Sorensen. She's a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and uses a manual wheelchair. She came across a promotional video for the Firefly late one night a few months ago and says it gave her a jolt.
You know, it was just the image of being free. I could get around pain-free and not have to worry about, you know, can I get up this hill? Can I make it to this meeting? Because it's not easy to drive to.
Since buying one in June, Sorensen says the Firefly has changed her life. For the first time, she could drink a cup of coffee on her way to class. She says it's a common assumption that people with disabilities just can't do things.
The most limiting part of my disability is not my actual body, but the environment around me. You know, people with disabilities are people first, and we want to participate, and we can participate in life. We just might have to do it differently.
Sorensen and Holmes both noted that at some point, everyone will experience disability, whether through injury, pregnancy, or the unavoidable advance of age. They say all people deserve to have choices, to have fun, and they'd gladly pay for services that provide both. Margaret J. Krause, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Regional Alliance, the economic development and marketing arm of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development, has a new leader. Mark Thomas began as president of the PRA in mid-July. Mark, welcome to The Confluence.
Great, thank you.
And we're also joined in studio by the CEO of the Allegheny Conference, Stephanie Pashman. Welcome back to the program, Stephanie.
Great to be here again, Kevin.
Mark, I'm going to start with you. You were senior vice president of partnerships for the New York City Economic Development Corporation. So why come to a smaller city, a smaller market?
Because Pittsburgh and the region were looking for a leader who would really advance the regional strategy, would really elevate the region to be as dynamic and build on the assets that currently exist, and will really empower and inspire people to fulfill the aspirations for the region. And that was the type of role I was looking for at this place in my career.
Stephanie, what did the Allegheny Conference see in Mark for the PRA?
So Mark brings a really nice blend of skills to the Allegheny Conference. First of all, he certainly has an understanding of kind of the newer, more progressive ideas around economic development and business attraction, both on the domestic and international front, that can help really fuel job growth and propel our economy in terms of bringing the right kinds of businesses into Pittsburgh. And in addition, he actually brings a really interesting perspective of working on a regional basis in really large markets, which is what we do at the Allegheny Conference. We think about having a strong urban core of the city of Pittsburgh, but then make sure that we're also propelling activity and regional vibrancy in a 10-county footprint.
Understanding that it's a process and no real end point per se, Mark, what are your initial impressions about what Pittsburgh, this region, still needs to do?
Well, I would say the assets are quite strong. And what I mean by that is we have a lot of land that can be developed. Across all 10 counties, we have strategic opportunities that they see as places they love to develop and attract jobs and investment. Within the urban core, you see where the universities are spinning out great technology, and there's a lot of interest from people outside of the region to invest in the region. And so the first thing we have to do is really elevate our best message possible and really make sure that it reflects the diversity of the economy and just the potential for growth on the workforce side and on the innovation side. The second is really start mapping out a strategy around growth, and that includes really attracting the types of investments that will create good jobs, that will be inclusive jobs, and then position the region for continued success.
Stephanie, so what's the decision process like? Where you focus your energy, your resources to attract new businesses to the region?
So I think it's certainly what we've learned over the years is that the more you do it in partnership with the key stakeholders that are in this game with you. So the universities and the education system is a critical partner. The public sector is a critical partner. The existing business community being a partner. And your overall amenities and assets that are in your market are a partner. And figuring out together what it is that we think we can position ourselves to attract and accept and blend in here. And it's also then the second piece is what is the culture in Pittsburgh and how do you be part of the civic fabric? Because we have a very specific way of partnering and welcoming you and fitting you in, and we want it to be the right kind of business that can fit into that environment.
Part of it is really developing good market intelligence on where there's growth opportunity for this region. And once we get a sense of that, and that includes the university saying employers are asking us for this type of talent, or companies are looking for these type of markets to expand that work well for our region.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about economic development in the region with Stephanie Pashman, CEO of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development, and Mark Thomas, the new president of the Pittsburgh Regional Alliance. We all know that old saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. But does it really, when it comes to economic development in our region, in terms of equitable investment? Stephanie?
It will. I would say
that implies it doesn't
exactly.
Right now.
Well, there's a few things. I mean, right now, from you look at economic indicators, and we're lagging behind our benchmark cities, our comparison cities, cities we aspire to be like, and the national average on metrics of population growth, job growth, and GDP growth, right? So we first have to position ourselves to think about where the opportunities are, because the more that we all grow our tax base and be able to invest back into what the community needs, the better we can be. And I think what's really significant is how much we are spending our time learning from the mistakes of other cities in growth trajectories that have not been equitable or inclusive or have failed the greater good. And so for us, it's more about how do we make sure that that happens in a manageable way so that we can make sure the assets come back and accrue to everybody.
So what is being done so that certain communities, such as the African-American community, aren't left out of economic progress and so that women are full participants in this? Mark, do you have ideas coming into town?
Yeah, and I would say one of the biggest value props, and this was like a personal thing for me, was when I was just kind of getting a sense of like, what does the region want? I saw the rural parts wanted to be part of growth, and the urban parts wanted to be part of growth. The African-American community wanted to be part of the growth. And so how do you make sure they are active in the pursuits that we go after? And then how do we make sure that when employers choose our region, that they're actually investing and supporting the pipeline so that we can actually deliver on that?
I think one of the things that's very unique about the Allegheny Conference model, which plays into this type of opportunity, is that I always say we sell the region, but it's also our job to kind of fix it and improve it and make it better. And so while Mark is out there thinking about the opportunities for positive improvement in our economy, that the rest of the team and the rest of the our partners can help think about how we eliminate those barriers to success, whether it be putting together workforce programs that are a key part of our activities, whether it's about policy change at the state or federal level, whether it's about inclusion and the work we're doing to make sure we bring around disenfranchised communities. And all of that are part of our agenda, but it's really about fueling it on a view towards how we make sure that we are making the economy thrive collectively.
So how do you convince companies that, shall we say, are progressive looking, that are more inclusive, saying, well, geez, I'd like Pittsburgh, but what are you doing to make the region more inclusive?
No, that is part of, well, I would say every company and every project, there's a different pitch. There's a larger narrative that these are the values that we put at the forefront. And then there is a strategy for whether you're a company that's in tech or whether you're a company that's in healthcare. What we map out here is how you reach a diverse audience in our region. And we have the capacity to deliver on that.
Right, so we recently had a real big success with a company called Affirm that landed on the north side from San Francisco, and we're one of their kind of their next headquarter outside of the Bay Area. And this was a company that is founded by somebody who was one of the founders of PayPal. So they came here, and I think what we had to show them is, number one, there's an ecosystem here that's growing that you can help develop, and they wanted to be part of that. So that was number one. They saw the opportunity to fit into something bigger and want to be bigger. They saw a place that they could be. They saw places that their staff, who they actually relocated several from the Bay Area, could live here and could feel part of it. They saw the amenities and they saw the overall potential in the business community. So I think it's also about having a multifaceted approach that sells their talent while you're selling the company and while you're helping that CEO see himself and his vision of his company fitting into our overall business community.
Stephanie Pashman, CEO of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development, and Mark Thomas, the new president of the Pittsburgh Regional Alliance, are our guests. Stephanie, does the Pittsburgh region, through the Allegheny Conference or the PRA, do we have a brand, and does it evolve as Pittsburgh evolves?
So I would say we don't have a brand today that we feel that everybody has bought into. I think there's a lot of different ways that we sell Pittsburgh. We worked really hard, particularly during the Amazon process, to get in a unified way. But what we realized in the Amazon process is that what we're lacking is the strength of that brand in marketing and communication, and that we're being too generic. We're saying similar things to every other city, and what we're not doing is putting our best assets first. So that's number one on our agenda right now that will be done by the early fall, is the real brand that helps us collectively see all of ourselves in it. And then what people like Mark and others will help take that and make it customized for the kinds of companies and the kinds of talent we want to bring here so they can see themselves within it.
What do you want it to embody, the message?
I think it needs to embody our history and our future collectively. And that's one of the things that's a little bit of a challenge. But what we hear from people who come to Pittsburgh is we have such a rich history, and we have such a rich history in industry and in the types of people that built this place. But there's a future that looks very different for kinds of people who are going to be in learning jobs, in innovation jobs, who don't know about our steel history and who need to understand the collective. And so the blend of how robotics is fueling advanced manufacturing and how we work collectively in seeing one unified economy from the past to the future and established industrial with future learning economy, that blend is really critical that it be together and be seen as a unified approach.
Yeah, and I think what pays tribute to the region's history is that we are one of the American gateways of innovation. And we are one of the American gateways of culture and all things great about this country. And so when companies and talent are looking for a home, they should see that they can be successful and be part of where people in this world look to kind of what is next. And that next economy really is here. And that, to me, is part of the value proposition.
This is the 75th anniversary for the Allegheny Conference, one of the first public-private partnerships in the nation. This summer, you convene the next 75 summit. What tangible results came from this that can be implemented, and how soon?
So what came from it was we have a list of 100,000 ideas that came out. But I would say the top ideas that came out, I would say there are probably three. One is the idea of connectivity. How do we connect the urban core to the broader region? How do we create connectivity on the infrastructure side? So the overall theme of connectivity you'll see in our agenda moving forward, whether it's mobility, whether it's 5G, broadband, or whether it's connectivity in terms of actual physical, that we all feel part of the same thing. Number two, the idea that we want to grow our economy and that we need a talent pipeline that aligns with it and that people need to feel part of that success. So it's this whole theory of inclusion in the success of the broader region. And I would say there's also another whole ball of activity around how we define what that economy looks like and how people can feel that we can do the strength of energy and manufacturing at the same time that we are fueling knowledge and fueling technology.
Mark, so for you, what is your near-term goal?
To really get to know the region, really understand the opportunity that they feel like as well, that they're part of the economy they own, that they're well positioned to contribute that to our broader strategy, and then really help them understand how we want to move the region forward and leverage all the assets and people to really make that happen.
Stephanie Pashman is the CEO of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Mark Thomas is the new president of the Pittsburgh Regional Alliance. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Allegheny County is among the vast majority of counties in the state that's under a mandate to replace old voting machines with ones that have a paper trail of ballots cast to increase security and to assure voters that the candidates they are choosing are actually getting their votes. Chris Potter is editor of WESA's Government and Accountability team. He joins us in studio. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Kevin.
So, County Board of Elections met last week. What happened?
So this was the chance for the county sort of convened a search committee to review the machines proposed by several companies that are sort of bidding on Allegheny County's contract to replace these machines. And the Board of Elections had sort of a formal presentation of a report from that search committee. It's made up by several people, all of whom are county employees working for the administration of Rich Fitzgerald. Mm. So the county heard this presentation, and sort of the big takeaway from this presentation was, although four companies submitted bids with their various systems, only one company, Election Systems and Software, has machines that are certified to handle the large number of ballots, candidates, and races that Allegheny County faces. This is a county with 130 municipalities. It's got over 40 school districts. You start to think about all the people who run for those races. Then you think about judges of elections, Democratic and Republican committee people. You're talking thousands of candidates, thousands of different ballot configurations, and only one company is certified. In other words, they got kind of state approval to offer machines that will handle that many systems. That doesn't mean they're the only ones that can do it, but that they're the only ones certified.
And of course, those races will really kick in 2021, the municipal races.
That's right. The ballot for next year is comparatively straightforward compared to what we get in the off years. Right.
That company, Election Systems and Software, sounds familiar.
Yeah, probably because they are the folks that operate the iVotronic touchscreen systems that we use here in Allegheny County. And they're a big vendor. They do a lot of other, they offer the same kind of system in a lot of other counties, both in the region and across the state.
So is there no other choice? I mean, is it just ES&S or nobody?
Well, you get into a spirited argument about this because some of the active, a lot of voter advocates, ES&S is sort of a controversial company for reasons we could talk about. A lot of voter advocates say, hey, just because they're the only ones certified currently to do this work, to handle this many races, that's not to say there aren't other machines that could. A lot of these folks really like another company's machines, Hart InterCivic. That remains an open question, but the Board of Elections folks I talked to, and this is a three-person board, and I talked to two members, both of them seemed really wary of investing in a system that isn't quite certified to do everything they think it needs to do.
With the hope that this other company might be able to do it in the future in time for 2021.
That's correct. And this Hart InterCivic has said, they've sent a letter that says, we're committed to doing this. We think we can do it, and we are committed to get ourselves up to speed and do what you need.
Why is there a bit of a lack of trust, though, with ES&S?
So ES&S is a very controversial company, and it's controversial for a few reasons. Some of it has to do with the machines themselves. All of the systems, for example, that Allegheny County is looking at run a version of Windows 7 software. That's the basis, and this is like Windows 7. Even those of us who work in media don't use computer systems that old. The other factor is that the company itself plays a pretty kind of sharp-elbowed inside game. There have been reports from the eastern part of the state in Philadelphia and Luzerne County about using various kinds of, you know, influence. There was a Luzerne County official who they made part of their advisory committee, got to take free trips to Vegas. They gave money to elections officials in Philadelphia as well. And so there's a long controversy attached to that firm.
All right. So briefly, what's next?
So what's
next? What's the deadline?
So, well, you can't get a hard and fast deadline, which is interesting. But what's very clear is the county needs to make an order here sometime this fall because they got to order the machines, take shipment of the machines, train the workers to use the machines. There are 1,300 polling places. The workers, all those places do. What the Board of Elections did is they're having a stress test to make sure all of these machines can handle the kinds of ballots we have in Allegheny County. It remains to be seen how long it takes to get that test completed.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, the Real Abilities Pittsburgh Festival presents award-winning films that promote awareness and appreciation of the lives, stories, and artistic expressions of individuals with disabilities. We'll speak with the leader of Film Pittsburgh and an Australian director. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.